The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government. The point is, if they have it all, doesn't that equate to holding all the cards, as it were, and therefore commanding the riches that come from it?
You would think so.
You would think so, right?
Yeah.
Why not?
We have a term in political science called the resource curse, and it's this idea that some countries, especially ones that have more easily extractable, some of these easily extractable mineral resources, actually really fail to develop economically the way that other countries who are not resource rich do. And so Congo, the DRC, like that has been case in point.
Aloha, and welcome to Strategic Voices. I'm James Minnick, Colonel of the United States Army, retired, and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. I'm joined today by my colleague, Professor Andrea Mulgee. This is episode 4, Critical Minerals, Who Sets the Price? Modern power depends on materials most people never see. Critical minerals and rare earth elements underpin advanced defense manufacturing, semiconductor fabrication, battery storage, precision guidance systems, and secure communication infrastructures. Yet the real contest is not simply about who owns the minerals. It's about who controls the processing, the pricing, and the movement of these materials through the global economy. That contest is increasingly centered in the Indo-Pacific. While mineral reserves are globally dispersed, the most strategically important stages of refining, conversion, and transport are concentrated in this region. China today dominates much of the world's rare earth processing capacity, and the shipping corridors that carry these materials through the South China Sea, the Taiwan Strait, and the Straits of Malacca set inside a region already defined by strategic competition. In response, the United States and its partners are attempting to reshape the system. Initiatives such as Project Volt, coordinated price floor mechanisms, and the New Forum on Resource Geostrategic Engagement, or FORGE, aim to stabilize mineral markets, support new supply chains, and reduce dependence on concentrated processing networks. History, however, offers a caution. The United States has repeatedly mobilized industrial policy to secure critical minerals during crises, only to dismantle those systems once stability returned. The challenge today is not simply launching new initiatives. It is sustaining the industrial capacity, alliances, and market architecture required to make them endure. So the question is no longer just who mines the minerals. It is who sets the terms of access to them. Critical minerals, who sets the price? Let's begin. Andrea, welcome. How are you doing?
Good, James. Thanks for having me.
Oh, goodness. What a crazy week we have had. It has done nothing but rain for the last 2 weeks straight, right? And it has brought a lot of suffering to a lot of people. In fact, people here that we work close with have suffered significantly from these Kona storms that have beset the island for the last couple of weeks. You stay dry or different?
Took off last week for spring break, so there was no going to the beach. There was nothing like that. It was staying inside for the most part. So we were okay, but yeah, our friends on the North Shore, it's been really bad over there. We've had a lot of alumni that's been checking in to see how we're doing.
Yeah.
Concerned about everybody here.
Sounds like board games with the children. Is that something like that or something different?
There were some board games, there were some movies, but we also tried indoor rock climbing. So that was something. I was not very good at it, but I tried.
The walls probably aren't high enough is probably the problem you've got.
No, even the easiest one, I was struggling. So.
Oh my goodness. So I just got back. I flew out Thursday. I'd mentioned before, maybe I did. Flew out Thursday. I had a funeral in the family on the mainland. And so went out for that and flew back. While I was, it was good to see family, of course. The circumstances were quite unfortunate, but it was good to spend time with family. On the way out and on the way back, on the plane, I read this book by Nicholas Nearchus, The Elements of Power, A Story of War, Technology, and the Dirtiest Supply Chain on Earth. really insightful. Maybe I'll mention a couple of things from this. In addition to rock climbing at home, what else you had going on?
I've been working on some articles,
Yeah.
so we'll see, hopefully forthcoming here pretty soon. But I was just taking a break. It's been really busy, so it was nice to just have some downtime.
Before we get going too deeply on this, let me mention that Shyam, our colleague, Professor Shyam Taqwani, wanted to be here. But the vicissitudes of life kind of hit him, and here we are. He's not here. He did share with me, I know he told you about it, he shared with me a paper that he's writing. Actually, he's finished writing, he's waiting on it being published now. The Potato Logic of Power: How Efficiency Forges Strategic Vulnerabilities. It was a fun read in classic Shyam writing style. I'll try to pull on that a little bit here, but we miss him not being here with us
He
today.
feels a little, it feels empty over here.
Doesn't it? My goodness. You sent us a whole lot of things to read, and it was really interesting. And one of these pieces that I'll just tout for you was one of your pieces that you recently, I guess it was the end of last year, right? You released it here in the Strategic Nexus, Critical Minerals and Coercive Power in the Indo-Pacific. That was a fun read, too.
Thank you.
In fact, some of the things I mentioned in my intro were prompted by things you had written. You probably recognize some of that. Tell us about some of the writings that that we got to read this week.
Yeah, I first just want to say why I selected this
Ooh,
topic
please do.
for this week. And I was telling you earlier, it's almost felt like we were going back to our science class, and you even have a
I
periodic
do have
table
a
about
periodic table
nitrogen.
here.
And just being familiar with some of these elements, especially the rare earth ones, that can be even difficult to pronounce. And in these like seventh grade science classes, we talk about like what are the basic building blocks of life? These are all of the things that kind of we don't necessarily ever see them, but they're essential for the functioning of everything. And so similarly, when we're thinking about critical minerals, that's what they are. They are part of everyday modern life, and we don't always see them, but it's in every single thing. Tech-wise that we are using, whether it's our smartphones, our watches, our computers, our batteries, it's there and it's a part of it. And sometimes we don't really think about all of the supply chains and everything that's going on to get us to that end product. Like we have some awareness of it, but it's just become almost a background of our everyday lives. And that's just for a regular civilian. Beyond that, we can think about like all of the missile guidance, the weapon systems, all of these things that rely semiconductors on critical minerals and rare earths that are kind of functioning in the background without us kind of giving too much thought to it. But these are part of the technology that makes everything faster, smaller, and as its name suggests, critical. And so you can't really function in the modern world without having access to these critical minerals. So that was kind of the foundation that pushed me to think that we should talk about this today is what do we mean by critical minerals? What is the supply chain for these critical minerals? What does it mean to have them versus to process them? And so yeah, in our most recent episode, we talked about disruption and division. And when we think about critical minerals and power, we have to also think about how that plays in. What does it mean to have power today? And we can't think about how power is projected and what it means to have that without having this discussion about critical minerals. Because, thinking historically, if we look back to think about what it meant to have power, it's access to resources always been part of it from, colonialism. To talking about, oil exploration. I think that moment is critical minerals today. So influence is going to shift from, the countries that have oil to the countries that not necessarily just have the minerals, but who have the capacity and capabilities to refine and process, manufacture these. And it's heavily concentrated, as you mentioned in your opening. It's just a handful of countries that are actually doing this this processing, and that can lead to a new form of global competition. It may shape how alliances are working, and that has an impact on economic and national security. Is at the core of it. So it's not just about where are these minerals and who's processing, but how does that relate to how we're thinking about power, not just within the Indo-Pacific, but in the entire world.
You know, as you're talking about power, it made me immediately reflect back on Shams' paper, The Potato Logic of Power. Of course, he's talking about, he draws a connection with the with potatoes and how with blight and how they caused a condition of power on where these who had accessible potatoes. But the point he brought up on this power is the very one you brought up, which is that in the 19th century, you could equate the power, this power, to the control of coal and iron in the 20th century to to oil, and now in this 21st century to rare earth elements and frankly, probably, as we're going to talk about in some regards, a broader aspect of that, the critical minerals. And so I think that it was helpful in seeing how this source of power has altered over the years. And this now is a period where critical minerals and rare earths, and we need to define that for people listening right now so that they can understand that better, but how this is that period, that era. You want to start us out on talking about that?
And you may have come across in your readings this quote by Deng Xiaoping, who said, the Middle East has oil, but China has rare earths. And so this is just a long-term strategy of knowing that this is something to invest in because of its long-term potential. So this is something that, China has also been thinking about for a really long time is, the wealth that comes with rare earth minerals.
So let me hold you on rare earths. Is that okay? You know, you talked about pulling back on the periodic tables of our youth. There are 118 elements on that table, and 17 of those elements are rare earth elements. That's a small subset. Most of them, as I've come to realize, are at the bottom stratum of this table. In the first half are light elements, and the latter half are heavy elements. And these are not things we can name them off. Probably no, and I could. I've got them in front of me. We'll allude to some of them, but other than those people who actually are following this, they'll have never heard of these elements. And they're not rare because they only exist in a few places on the planet. But they're rare because they're mixed within all of the elements that are they don't come in hunks. They come in separated throughout the elements that are dug up and pulled through. And the rare part is how do you actually process and refine them? Say more.
It's incredibly labor intensive to be able to refine these. Sometimes taking hundreds, if not thousands, of cycles to get to the level of purity that you want. And so it's very labor intensive. And it's also sometimes just not found in economically mineable concentration. So it's not very worthwhile, especially if you are an industry that's looking to make profit. So that's why there's often a lot of need for state-led intervention if you want to invest in rare earths. But to distinguish between what we're talking about between critical minerals and rare earth, I think it's important to kind of step back and say, okay, what are critical minerals? What do we mean when we say critical? And that depends on who you're asking.
Okay.
Because so for critical minerals, that is a list that is country specific. It is determined by what a country deems is critical to, their supply chain or their national security. So every country has their own list of critical minerals. The US has a quite large list. It was recently expanded to 60 of those. Other countries, for example, the EU and Canada, I think have around 34. So depending on who you ask, what is a critical mineral, that depends what country we're talking about.
And so, if the United States has a critical mineral list of 60 elements, that's half the periodic table, roughly. I note that you would ask yourself, how long, is this something we've had around for a long time, critical mineral list? And the answer is no, we really haven't. The United States is on its third critical mineral list, and the first one came out in the first Trump administration and was announced in 2018, and it had 35 critical minerals on it, and now it's nearly doubled that, right?
Yeah, and based on what your priorities are, these can change just as it grew. And there's some that are kind of considered critical adjacent. If you talk to certain industries, they'll say, oh, we really think that this will be a mineral that will move on to that list in the short term, but it's not yet on the list. So it just it depends, again, what a country has decided, but it emphasizes the priority of focusing on these specific minerals.
I think it's a little largely to do with accessibility. If we had large reserves or large sources, mining sources in the country of certain mineral, then perhaps maybe it's important, but it's plentiful and it's accessible. It wouldn't make it onto the list because we have access to it. But I think with the geopolitical competition that has been going on, particularly as it has stiffened over time, increasingly it has become harder to gain access to so many of these resources that you were noting are, you know, are a plethora in China and in other places. And so here we are with a long list of critical minerals on our list.
And the rare earths, to just to go back to those and how they're different, like you mentioned, they're not necessarily rare in their existence. It's just rare in how difficult it can be to actually get them to the final form that you need. So even if you have one place that is starting to process it, it might be processed into like a powdered form, but then it's shipping to another location to go into its final form, say from that powder into a magnet. So that is something that is very labor and cost intensive. And so these rare earths are going to have elements that are unique, that are very important in things like defense systems. So it's like they have magnetic, luminescent, catalytic properties that you cannot find elsewhere except through this process. So that's why they may not be profitable to manufacture, but they are important for national security purposes.
So let's slow this down and let's help people understand. So if you've got a open pit mine and you are blowing that up, creating these big chunks of earth, that's the first process, right? Then you take and you have to transport it, and you have to take it to a facility where it can be pulverized, broken down, and that goes through a milling process. And in the milling process, it creates it into more of this powder you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so here you've got the powder, and then how do you get that? How do you separate it so that you actually have the rare earths that are in it? So you've mined for them, you have them. And so then that has to go through this flotation. You add water and it mixes it up, and the reagents in that then causes the minerals to come to the top. And then they kind of get kind of like when you're cooking and you get all this froth on top and you pull that off. That's where the minerals of them come to. And so now you're stuck with that. That's what you've got. And what you're stuck with is all the tailings, which have been down at the bottom, and you're going to have to work through getting rid of those. But then you've got to take it and you've got to dry that out. You've got to create it into a more refined process. And as you said, this can go over and over several times before you get to the purity level you want. But even in this later phase, then you've got to break it out between the different minerals that are in there, different rare earths that are in there. And so the process is what China has been doing for some time, and they've gotten really good at it.
Yeah. Well, I think you're ready to be a science teacher.
First of all,
because you went through and explained that really well. But China has dominated in this because they've been focused on doing it really since the 1980s, and they've been taking on certain costs to do so. So the big one, of course, at the front is that there's just really a lot of environmental costs that come from that. So these processes that you're speaking about, they have negative impacts on the environment. And for a lot of countries, that was just something that they didn't want to happen in their own backyard. And so they were willing to outsource it. And China was one of those countries, since the 1980s, that was willing to take on that cost, but also saw kind of this long-term future that this is something that can be valuable in the long term. And so there was state investment, like most things in China, right, that was seen as valuable. So that allowed China to really begin to dominate in this process, so that even if it's going to be done outside of China, so for example, learning, you know, doing smelting, like this is just something that China is able to also operate in other countries and be able to do that other places as well, because they have just dominated this industry for decades, because they've been willing to bear those bigger costs.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, when you think about what was going on in this time period that we're talking about, so the U.S. is rising in awareness of the environmental impacts of doing this, number one. Number two, it's only in this period, this beginning in the 80s, that even development of these permanent magnets you're talking about, this neodymium and the praseodymium magnets, which are used, they're and used in all the things we do right now, the high-tech stuff, didn't even exist before, I think, 1982. And so there, it was more, you know, conventional minings with, you know, the copper, the iron, the larger minerals that we were using for so many of the typical types of munitions. The rare earths weren't a factor until this period here. But then, as we talked about, I guess last episode, with the Cold War and how that brought about change. Cold War ends in 1991. There's a great peace dividend. We have had all of these stockpiles. Not stockpiles of rare earths, but stockpiles of critical minerals that don't seem as important anymore, because we're probably not going to fight wars like this anymore, right? We've kind of gotten through this. How'd that work?
Yeah, we try to keep learning from our past, but it's every time is a different iteration. But there's still some lessons there to be learned. And then there's also kind of this, you know, this, if we think about economic development and what countries want to specialize in, the United States also saw itself moving away from things like, you know, mining. Yes. That wasn't seen as like, we are going to be a more post-industrial society. We're not going to focus on mining. So if something that was, you know, moved away, just as the focus was, we're going to move more into tech and a services type industry. And we can get these other things from friends who, you know, are willing to bear those environmental and health costs. And we don't need to do that here anymore. I come from Kentucky. That's a big coal mining country, right? And so just seeing in my own lifetime, that transition, you know, as there's fewer and fewer coal mines, right? As people were moving away, is that not being as important of an industry? So if we look back, you know, the U.S. has had at different moments where it realizes, oh, there's a supply chain weakness. Even, you know, going back to World War I, and this is still, you know, the colonial era where, you know, the United Kingdom, Great Britain is getting a lot of its resources from its colonies. And still, there's a focus on, oh, after the end of the war, we realized there was shortages. Things like platinum, for example, was one of the ones. So then going into World War II, which, you know, after the Great War, you know, it wasn't called World War I, because that was, you know, thought to be the war to end all wars. Right. But the U.S. realized that it is going to be most likely entering into this global war, and it wants to establish its first strategic mineral stockpiles, right, in 1938, 1939. And so it started doing what we would call global mineral diplomacy, where it's reaching out to countries in Latin America, especially, but also in the Congo, to help have, you know, access to some of these minerals. Have another act in 1946 to strengthen federal mineral acquisition. So then we get into the kind of Cold War era, and still focusing on the Defense Production Act in 1950. They're still continuing on with mineral diplomacy, but then you get to Kennedy. And when he becomes president, just seeing like it's kind of, hey, why do we have so many large stockpiles? That seems so unnecessary. It's excessive. There was a move to not be so focused on having these stockpiles, but instead, how about having this group of allies or from around the world where we can do this instead, right? And that's also part of kind of, economic diversification as well. So that's where we have the rise of China and the globalization era. And China starts subsidizing the rare earth industry, critical minerals. And the US starts to have more regulatory issues as well about, Environmental Protection Agency and how we're going to protect the environment. And so that was most of this was pushed away. So we're getting rid of the stockpiles and we're going to be more focused on how do we have a supply chain that's outside of the US, but we still have access to. So then that kind of gets us to where we are now, which is just that push from really the 1960s onwards, where we're going to have a more global, we're in a more globalized world. We're entering after the end of the fall of the Soviet Union, and we're entering into this new era of globalization. We don't need to focus on mining and having access to that. Other countries are doing that. So that's where we kind of get into this issue of supply chain resilience and where all of these things are coming from.
Yeah. And, if I was going to pull more on last episode where we spoke about disruption, division, and competition, it is because this disruptions that we have had over the last several years has exposed the vulnerabilities that we have. We have realized that relying on China, particularly for access to these critical minerals, these rare earths, has intensified our vulnerabilities and put us in a position that has required us to do something different. And that different has been manifested in several things. The critical minerals list, which was directed in 2017 with executive order, put in the first one in 2018. But even as we go, I mean, the last couple of episodes, we've made mention of several different types of efforts that have gone on. Early in last month in February, there was the Critical Minerals Ministerial, where I guess it was Secretary of State Rubio had convened a group of a large group, 55 countries, including the European Commission, right, came together to talk more on a partner basis on how to do these things. And at that meeting, he put forward the FORGE, right? And so, you want to pull a little bit on that and what that did and how it's trying to get states to work on this collectively?
Yeah, so that was, and that's just happened very
It
recently,
is.
just
Yeah, it
February,
was
I
just like
think.
February 4th.
Yeah, so this is one of a number of initiatives that's being taken recently. And this one is about how do you coordinate with these other friendly countries about how we can diversify our supply chains, looking at what critical minerals that country has. And this, in addition to what you mentioned as well in the opening, which is the Project Vault. So this is happening around the same time. It's $12 billion that's been invested in strategic mineral reserve to stockpile nickel, cobalt, lithium for different industries, but using both public loans and private capital to back that to help support it. Because if you don't have that level of kind of state support behind it, it can the market is quite manipulated. Because anytime a private company is trying to put out whether it's critical mineral products or byproducts or rare earths, because of the dominance that China has in this market, it can be very difficult to be competitive on a global market because they'll dump and make it very difficult to compete.
Yeah, so both of those then, both the trading block that we have in FORGE, as well as the domestic stockpile with Project Vault, both of them set pricing floors, right? So that they can get a so that they can not be held up by a potential artificial dropping of the floor and make it uncompetitive anymore. And so countries and companies then must sign into this to be able to agree that they will procure these at that floor. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. And that's again it's kind of a state type of intervention to help address this kind of these problems, especially if it's a private company. It can be very difficult to compete internationally when your prices are being undermined.
Yeah, so as I understood in the project vault, so they're going to put within there all 60 of the critical minerals from the list. As you've rightly noted, it was a $12 billion public-private partnership, $10 billion from the government, another $2 billion from the private. But this is intended so that companies continue to use it as kind of a place to pull from, so that it's stayed current. It's the minerals are they're not sitting there fallow, but they continue to use from them, and that it is there so that in the event of a crisis, we don't go through kind of like the strategic oil reserves, right? I mean, it tries to get you through a period of crisis that allows you to not suffer from lack of resources, which we actually went through a lot of that when we had the COVID crisis that hit us, that, or even frankly in 2008, the Great Financial Crisis. It caused all these problems in the system that slowed drastically production and different fields and stuff.
Yeah, and it shows you what are some of the potential challenges of when you are overly reliant on just one country, even if you don't have a conflict or crisis with that country. Things like natural disasters or disruptions in shipping, all of those things, if you're relying on one country for that, then that's incredibly disruptive, and that has all sorts of ripple effects that can come from. So it's not just about potential, competitors, geopolitical competitors, but it's also about economic resilience as well. As you diversify the sources of where you're getting things, it's really important for economic stability as well. So I think this is, certainly it helps with national security, but it also helps with some, economic elements as well. If because of the way that it's been so concentrated, you have to try to overcome that over reliance on one country that's processing everything.
You mentioned the Congo, and you mentioned cobalt, and I had several thoughts I thought I might share. One of them was, it's a reminder of how the technology is bringing about the importance of certain minerals, and so the lithium-ion battery and the use of cobalt in that is, and it's just, I mean, those batteries are in everything. Yes, of course, they're in EVs, and they're in phones, and they're in power walls, and they're just everywhere. And as a result, this mineral, which used to frankly be seen as an impediment in the core copper, silver, nickel that it was found in, has come to be a very important resource that is found dominantly in the Congo. I was reading in Nyarkos's book, and he shared a story in here that in 1735 it was the first year that cobalt was refined. 1735. So that was quite a few years ago.
Yeah, just so far
Y
behind.
yeah, yeah. And so, but it was. Miners saw it as a nuisance because they were mining silver, nickel, copper, those things, and so it was this impurity that was interlaced within it. And they found some use. It was useful in blue pigments and because of the hue that it gives off and everything. But they named it the German name from cobalt, which is an impish spirit that miners blame for spoiling their ore. And
Today.
so that is how
Yeah.
we come by the name cobalt.
It's a good trivia.
There's a good trivia pursuit, right? You
Yeah.
could use that somewhere. Nicholas Nyarkos enlightened me on that. But the point being is that at one point it was useless, near useless, this material. And today it's near invaluable. And so you would think to yourself, or maybe you might, if the Congo has all this resource, and we talk about why that's so prolific in cobalt, but the point is, if they have it all, doesn't that equate to holding all the cards, as it were, and therefore commanding the riches that come from it?
You would think
You
so.
would think so, right?
Yeah.
Why not?
We have a term in political science called the resource curse, and it's this idea that some countries, especially ones that have more easily extractable, some of these easily extractable mineral resources, actually really fail to develop economically the way that other countries who are not resource rich do. And so Congo, the DRC, like that has been case in point. It's just had, it's a combination of bad governance, a lot of history there. But you mentioned cobalt, and I had the stats sitting here in front of me
Please.
that Democratic Republic of Congo has 70% of the entire world's cobalt. And it's a big country, but still in one country, 70% of global cobalt. But China refines 75% of that in China, right? So a lot of these countries that have these resources, they are not being refined within country. They are being exported. And often they're not getting the return on investment. So they have the resources, but it's elsewhere. It's these companies that take
Processing of
the
it.
processing that is the skill set, right? So the extraction of cobalt not as difficult as certain other elements. So it's just able to more easily be extracted, but then it immediately being exported to be refined and go to the rest of the world. The amount that kind of trickles down into the economy of Congo, especially to its citizens, is very limited. There's historically been really poor governance in the Congo, and a lot of that, when there is that mineral wealth, it's been very, very concentrated in just the top leadership. So that's another thing that we see is that a lot of the mineral wealth of the world is sometimes in some of the countries that have really failed to develop.
Yeah, I mean, the Congo suffers from periods of being colonized. And that went on for quite a period of time, but they were colonized by Belgium in the, I guess, in the 18, what was it, 18, 85, I think, is probably when they were colonized. Belgium became a state in 1830. And so,
I don't think Congo became independent until maybe like 1960s,
yeah, and so then the Congo didn't, no, so
decolonization.
the, yeah, the decolonization came much later, and so, and then there was a number of level of corruption and things that happened, but I'm pulling the point that you spoke about with regards to, so they, they extract it out of the earth, can't do anything with it, it's got to be purified, they can't do it there, they don't have the capabilities, and so they send it off to China to do that. So here in the United States then, we actually don't have a lot of processing capacity either. In fact, we don't have a lot of mines. The largest mine that we have that operates in rare earths is in California, and it's the Mountain Pass California mine, run by owned by MP Materials. And you would think to yourself, well, we've had this for some time, haven't we? Well, the Mountain Pass mine has been around for a bit, but it closed during the period that you spoke about. There, because of the environmental problems and stuff, and so it closed. It was no longer profitable. China was doing well. It was only in this period that we're in now where we have realized a need to prioritize mining again and processing, that we've actually gone back to mining. And so that mine has been running for a bit, and it primarily excavates the bastnäsite, which is that composite that has to of high grade rare earth elements that has to that you know has the has actually several of the light rare earths in it that is then broken down. And one of the largest things they pull from that are the permanent magnets. Maybe I'll stop for a second, let you pull on some of those thoughts that
Yeah, so Mountain Pass is now processing 15% of rare earth elements, which is, significant compared to what it was, but small in the
where
global.
to feed.
Right. And so actually 60 Minutes yesterday just did a really good investigative
I
report
didn't
where
see the
they
show.
went to Mountain Pass to talk to the new owners who took over, I believe, in 2017 after,
Yes,
because there was
that's right.
bankruptcy. So they took over, I believe, in 2017 or.
2017 is when they took over, and there were 8 employees when they started. There's about
Right.
300 today, but
Yeah.
they started with, all right, let's get after it, pull you up your arm sleeves. And
Yeah. And they were going through the, you know, how complicated this process is. And even at the site in Mountain Pass, it's not the completed magnetic product that comes. It's the fine powder that you
Is
were talking about that is then shipped to Texas
Texas to
for,
Independence. Go ahead, say more.
yeah, no, I don't know the actual word, and I think you do, of how they turn it into the,
Well, so they've got it. MP Materials has a processing plant in Texas, just like you said. That's called Independence, is the plant, and that is where they take it all the way, and then they create the these permanent magnets.
yeah.
But I cut you off. Say more.
Well, one of the things that came out in that documentary, and I'd also been hearing on different other podcasts that are talking about this, is that just the amount of people, right, that are trained in this field that have the necessary knowledge to operate a mine, how many engineers are choosing to be mining engineers? It's not been the path that our grads are choosing to take. They'll take other types of engineering, but mining engineering is one of the least popular types of engineering. So if you are going to invest in these mines, actually finding a workforce that understands how mines work and you know, metallurgy and all of these things that are associated with it, it can be really difficult to find. So how are you going to staff the mine with the necessary knowledge to operate it is one problem that they've been facing. And again, it's such a labor cost intensive process to get to that. They showed these the powdered form that they ended up with and just how many cycles it took just to get to that. And so that's why they needed you know, assistance from elsewhere because it's just such a difficult process.
We are going to have to do something different to create the skill workforce that can do this. You mentioned the dearth of mining engineer experts that we produce out of our universities is quite small, very small, and that's not the case in China.
No.
You know, they produce these types of engineers in the droves, which makes them, and they've been doing this for decades, of course, as we indicated, but it is insufficient enough just to have a stockpile. You've got to have these other elements as well, right? And so creating, you know, Project Vault with the stockpiles, I mean, that's one aspect of it,
Start.
but there are so many other things we have to do. Skilled workers is one of them.
Yeah, and getting people to want to do that kind of jobs, and even thinking about, you know, things like shipbuilding, is who do you want to come into this industry who sees this as a viable future? So yes, we have this need, but how do we also get that an adapted workforce that is also interested in doing this as well can be one of the challenges as well.
So I wanted to pull just a minute on these magnets. So maybe not you, but as a boy, magnets were fascinating to me. I've got a teenage grandchildren. One of my grandsons was, I mean, just so into these magnets. And so you say to yourself, well, magnets are cool, but how cool are they and how important are they? These permanent magnets that we're talking about, these are unlike any magnet you're familiar with.
It's not your refrigerator
These are
magnet.
not your refrigerator magnets. Are you familiar a little bit with that? You want to say some more?
No, I think that it's just when we say magnets, it's not the types of magnets that we're typically thinking about. Something that's just like, oh, that these things are, you know, attracted to one another and we can use it to hold up our kids' artwork on the fridge. It's
Yeah.
much more about what it's in, you know, missile systems and things like that it's being used for.
And so this is where the neodymium and praseodymium are critical important in and something like 43% of the rare earths that we're mining are being used in these magnets. Of course, these are combined with, you know, lead and boron to create the magnets. I mean, all of the rare earths are compounded with other minerals to be able to create the thing. But this is, and so whether it's Mountain Pass or other places, a large, nearly a plethora of the product that is being made out of here. And, you know, this, and these are being used in cell phones and computers and automobiles and MRI machines and jet engines and wind turbines and electric vehicles and fuel cells and rechargeable batteries and on and on and on. And
It's an extensive list.
And these are really massive and extremely strong. I mean, you couldn't pull them apart in type of strong. And the way that they are used in these machineries or in weapon systems and stuff. And I mentioned that we've only been doing this since 1982 with these permanent magnets that we're describing right here. That's not that long. So I was in the Army when we started doing these things, to give you an idea of how contemporary it feels. But this is, and we are now creating those as well, like you had mentioned, down in MP Materials plant down in Texas.
Right, that's the main place that it's happening within the U.S. But again, it's definitely a shortage of where we're having this manufacturing at, and it goes back to the original challenge that we were talking about is having access to it because the U.S. has rare earths, but being able to then process it is how do you go from we mine it to we refine it and then we have an end product that is usable. And you know, different countries have also had different strategies of how to move around this challenge of being more than just somewhere where the mining happens. So Indonesia, for example, they have 50% of the world's nickel. And one of the laws that passed in Indonesia in the past 15 years or so is that, oh, the refining needs to actually happen within the country.
Because they also recognize that that's where the money is, right?
That is where money is, and their export values, it surged from 1 billion to over 30 billion in less than 10 years. It had a major impact. But you already know where I'm going with this, because even though it was a switch to it, the process is not going to be exported, it is going to be refined here, then open it up to companies, right? But Chinese companies do 90% of that processing within Indonesia. So it has had
great partnerships, is what it did.
Yeah. And it's just two companies from China that have 70% of that 90%. So it attracted a lot of foreign investment. It did increase the value for Indonesia, and it's created jobs as well. But again, it still didn't change the core of the problem, which is who has the know-how to do this and who is actually doing the manufacturing, the refining. And so Indonesia is a really interesting case study because they did see it as like, we need to change something that it's happening within our country, that this is happening, but it still identified the same problem. And other countries were interested as well, but they could not move as quickly as these state-owned enterprises that could set up shop very quickly and begin the refining process. So that's been Indonesia's strategy to try to move from just purely export-oriented to also, you know, have it mined, have it manufactured and refined here.
So there are several states that are mining and significant in the mining. Burma, Myanmar, pulls out quite a bit of rare earth. Of course, that all goes to China as well. So, I mean, that's a border state with them, and they've got great access to it. You just spoke about nickel coming out of Indonesia. We spoke earlier about cobalt coming out of DRC. But then even Canada. Canada has significant mines, but it's the processing that is hurting. And so even if we go back and we look here at the United States, there are a couple other mines that are opening, but this is just at the beginning. I'm not sure if you're tracking Ramaco Resources up in Wyoming. They're opening up the Brook Mine, and it is the first U.S. mining project that has opened up in 70 years. Just opened up.
That's crazy. 70 years.
70 years, right? Just opened up. And it will, extract neodymium, praseodymium, disoprosium, and other these permanent magnet metals that they will use, but they're just getting going. In Texas, they've got Texas Round Top, which is actually when they pull from there, they believe that this will be primarily the I guess lithium is they pull primarily from it, and there's a issue of if your primary source is also subject to spikes and or floors in mining. But in addition to that, they're looking to pull the heavy rare earths out of that. But this there are not a lot of companies or mines in the United States that are extracting, and then very few places that are processing. And so
There's
we are making great headways, but being
a lot
realistic about
of
this, there is
experiment
a
to do.
lot of space to be covered as we go through
And just
this.
real quick,
Please do.
Australia as well is one of the biggest producers of lithium, and they've introduced a new strategy as well, their critical mineral strategy. And they're doing something kind of similar to Project Vault, and working also closely with the US to do more of the refining and manufacturing within Australia, because they are also exporting a lot of it to be done in China as well. And so they've also done a $4 billion critical minerals facility to help give loans to different companies to help move more of these projects, not just to Australia, but they call it friendshoring. So also to reduce some of these supply chain vulnerabilities where it's just within a closer group of allies to reduce their reliance.
Yeah, I think Australia's got the Nolans project and the Brown Range projects, and financing coming out of EXIM export import banks and stuff to fund those. Oh my goodness!
It's a lot, but I think you gave a good science lesson today.
No, I actually. Thank you for you brought this as a topic. You've been thinking about this for a little bit. I know you wrote a paper on it late last year and put a lot of thought into that and visibility. Sham then started researching, and he wrote a paper on that. We've done this paper this today's talk on this. The amount of effort we're putting in critical minerals and rare earths is so different from when I walked in the door 10 years ago here. We didn't talk about it at all. And it seems like we're talking about it so much more. It's actually interesting.
It's so interesting. We do have a lot of catching up to do though. So for me, it's been like a deep dive trying to really learn some of these, like learn the names, learn how to pronounce them. You were brave and tried to pronounce some of those rare earths, and I'm just like rare earths. So there's a lot there, but it's very important, and I'm glad that we're focusing on it.
Now, thanks for bringing this. Let's go ahead and switch, and let's talk about wins and woes. What do you bring for us for a win today?
I'm going to continue with the theme.
Yeah, oh, shoot. You should.
And so we have some new partnerships that have been announced as recent as Friday. So there's a US-led defense manufacturing partnership for new missile motor production with Japan and drone cooperation throughout Asia, including a potential ammunition production line in the Philippines. $36 billion financed by Japan, including an oil export facility in Texas, an industrial diamonds plant in Georgia, and a natural gas power plant in Ohio. $600 million joint investment in a synthetic industrial diamond plant for Georgia. And so the reason that I mentioned that is because that's a material that's crucial for advanced semiconductors. So that's a really big win. And talking about how are we going to diversify this supply chain? How are we going to produce things here? How do we work with our allies and partners? That's a key example right there, working with Japan. So that's my major win for this past week.
A major win. It sounds like you might have a minor one in there. I'll hold you and you can follow up. I was thinking about my major win for this week. Maybe I could pull out on a couple of them, but there's a lot happening. Just last week, Thursday, there in Korea, they completed their 11-day Freedom Shield exercise. So it began earlier, the 9th of March. And we hold these are annual exercises. And among the things that came out of this, I was surprised pleasantly to hear about a exercise with air defense, and they had brought out this indirect fire protection capability, IFPC, Increment 2. And so this is a new capability. It's going to operate between short range systems and the higher altitude systems like the Patriot and the THAAD, and this is designed to intercept those cruise missiles, drones, and rockets that are coming at the lower altitudes. And so this is really interesting. They're looking at firing the AIM-9X Sidewinder missiles to be able to engage these, and then they, you know, this is synced via the integrated battle command system. I mean, this is the brain of the operation, and it takes and it transforms these standalone systems launchers, as it were, into a unified lethal mesh. Now they've got some work to do. There's plenty. There's other iterations they're looking at doing on this, but it is exciting how far advanced this is. They've had it in the field. They were and used it here during the exercise, Freedom Shield, that just ended. And so, I think that's a major win I bring to the table. Did you have a minor win you wanted to share?
I would say it's still related to what I was saying. It's just that, you know, we're talking about just how we have, you know, this forge and this vault really happening within the last month. We're already seeing that coming into play in action. So we go from, you know, ideas to action. And I think seeing how quickly that's developing, to me, that it's not a minor, it's major, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I snuck two in there.
Well, I'm going to sneak a second one. So Thursday last week, President Trump sat down in the White House with Prime Minister Takeuchi from Japan. And they spoke about a number of things. It was the first time that they had come together in the White House. They met on the sides previously in Korea during the APEC meeting. But anyway, President Trump had voiced full support to helping Japan with its long-standing abductee issue with North Korea. So this is a massively important, hugely important issue with Japan. They've been challenged since the early 2000s. Prime Minister Koizumi had met with leader Kim Jong-il. And they had had some progress made. So they had released five of the kidnapped victims, but this was never resolved. This is a big issue. And so adding this to an important list with the United States as they may engage with Kim Jong-un will be an important thing for the alliance. And so we'll see where this goes.
That's good.
Woes, do you have anyone you want to share with us?
So you just mentioned Freedom Shield,
Good.
and my woe is semi-related to that because, probably to no surprise of anyone, especially people like you who are following, you know, following North Korea and Korea experts, is that North Korea did launch 12 short-range ballistic missiles during that exercise. And so I don't think that's the first time that they've done that, and it won't be the last. But the fact that that's what they you know, did as their potential show of force during that exercise. And you know, semi-relatedly, there's a new report out from CSIS that there are North Korean workers who are going to Russia to help manufacture drones in the drone factories. So, you know, we've seen that increase of North Koreans who are going to fight in Russia. So we're seeing that kind of continued path of like how that is being exported.
Yeah.
North Koreans going to Russia.
Well, I'll just, since we're talking this, I'll pull a little into this. And talking about these drones, you know, the Shahed drones that are being used in by Iran, modified by the Russians, Grayman, I think is what they call it. And several years ago, they had gifted that to North Korea as well, and so they had those, and now. You know, with this continue working on here, drone warfare in this part of the world is also picking up very, very significantly. The Shahed drones are going to be fairly prominent on the battlefield, I think, going forward. This has been a wonderful time spent together.
Learned a lot.
We've gone a long ways in a short period of time. Quickly, what's coming up?
I'm getting ready to go to Australia in a couple of weeks. Again, you know, spoke about Australia. It's part of our Mars course. We're going out there. So that's the multi-armament resilience seminar that we have. And so I will be going with part of the team out there to prepare for the course that's coming up in June.
Very well. Very well. Well, I am going to real quickly get on a plane, fly out to DC area. We've got the Mobile Indo-Pacific Orientation course, so I'll head out for that. We're going to do that the first week of April, and so I'll be out there for that, and then I'll turn around and come on back after a week out there. But that's a next big one that is on my radar to tackle. Well, we missed Sham. We'll hope for him to be back on our
Yes.
next episode, yeah, which is next week. But thanks for sitting down and making us all smarter on
Yeah.
critical minerals.
Well, thanks for all the research you did. I learned a lot from you. Yeah.
Wonderful. From all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining Strategic Voices. Please subscribe to receive new episodes in your feed and rate us so others can more easily find the conversation. We hope you'll join us again on March 31st for Episode 5, Gen Z After Revolt. Is South Asia Turning a Corner? Youth-driven uprisings shook political systems across Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and Nepal. Now the ballots are in. Did generational mobilization produce real change, or did established party systems reassert themselves? Strategic Voices examines what the results reveal about political stability and institutional durability in South Asia. For Professors Sham Taquani and Andrea Maldi, I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.